you know, the easiest way to go green is to start by just going smaller. And just realize that particularly in the U.S., there's this real phenomenon. We've, over the last 60-odd years, supersized ourselves in this crazy way. So we have – it used to be 1,000 square feet per person. 1,000 square feet was sort of the average housing size. Uh-huh. Back in like the 50s, and now it's like 2,700 with smaller families. So, you know, the big numbers are we have three times the space per person that we used to. I mean, it's just, it's crazy.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start, I just want to share two quick things with you. If you have guest recommendations or stories that you think we should know about, shoot us an email at hello@unmistakablemedia.com. We love hearing from our listeners. And if you're looking for a keynote speaker for your event or want to bring our team at Unmistakable Creative to your event or organization for a workshop on creativity and productivity, visit unmistakablecreative.com/speaking, send us the details, and we'll be in touch. And as always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. Whether you're looking to start a new website or move an existing one, HostGator can help. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and if you want to move from an existing host to HostGator, they make it free and super simple. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Graham, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So, you know, I actually came across your story by way of the Minimalism documentary. And, you know, I saw that you created the website Life Edited. And then when I saw the apartment that you had built for yourself, I thought, one, I want one of those apartments. And two, I have to talk to this guy. But before we get into your actual work, I want to start by asking a question that I found has been very informative and interesting. And that is, what did your parents do for a living? And how has that impacted the choices that you have made with your life and your career?
That's a great question, and actually one that I really haven't thought about before, so I appreciate it. I know you don't usually share this stuff in advance, but I had to actually really think about it. And so the first quick answer is my dad was an airline pilot. You know, he's like 67, so it was really a different time, and his dad was in the Army and such. So he, you know, I think airline pilot was a great job, and so he did it, but pilots, the idea of a pilot is way more sexy than it actually is for in most cases, I think. I mean, in a way, it's like driving a big bus, and like there's just very specific rules, and so I think, you know, it was great money, and I'm proud of him. You know, it's a really important job, and you know, it's not easy to make happen and all that. But I think for him, it wasn't that exciting. He was putting in his time, and what was great about it was made reasonable money and allowed him to do other stuff. And so what he was really about was more, you know, small scale real estate development. Real estate development sounds so boring, but basically he grew up in a fairly sort of suburban setting, almost city. Uh-huh. And did what a lot of people did at that time, the hippies anyway, they did back to the land. So he sort of got out of there and moved to this sort of little hippie area about an hour and a half outside of Montreal, and just wanted to do things differently. And so this was the, you know, 70s, and he bought, I think it was 400 acres, which makes him sound very rich, but it's not really the case. I think land was just really cheap, and a lot of it was on the side of this mountain. And so he bought this big piece of land in the very much in the country, like 20 minutes out of like a tiny town. And this was the time like the Stuart Brand's Whole Earth catalog, and just sort of, you know, back to the land. Like, how do we do it? Anti-establishment, you know, how do we do things differently? And so he bought this land, and then I think what really inspired me and what sort of became part of me is just that he knows how to figure it out. He will figure it out. And so he really, despite not really coming from a construction background, he just figured it out. And so, like, he built this long driveway in, and then he found he really liked log cabins, and so there are these he found all these old log cabins in Ontario, sort of out in the middle of nowhere, often covered over, like barns and stuff. And basically bought them for like $1,500 a pop, and then dismantled them, put them on a truck, and brought them to Quebec. And then he put two of them together to create this really amazing house, just, you know, quite large, ironically. But we ended up having a lot of brothers and sisters. And he built a pond, and then we had like horses and chickens, and then he, you know, got into like he built it so that we could heat with wood. And then he put the well up on the side of the mountain, and so it was gravity feed. And then he had what's called a water jacket in the furnace. And so, and then we heat wood, as I said. We had like gas heating. We had hurricane lanterns, and so it was the kind of thing that the power would go out, and we'd have, you know, full heating, full lighting, and because of the water jacket and the gravity feed, we'd have warm showers. And so, you know, that big gardens and you know, making pickles and applesauce, and he just like would mass produce stuff. So it just, I think, you know, what really inspired me and impacted sort of my life was just this sense of like a little anti-establishment and sort of hippie and nature and health and being able to like figure stuff out. And he really did, and he ended up doing a bunch of different housing, these small developments. He just did a lot of building, and so that really, I think, set me on my path, which really was I've wanted to be an inventor since I was a child, and so it's just this idea of sort of coming up with things, and so I think that, and then just having the guts to figure it out and do it, and I think so that's probably really, you know, my dad. And maybe what's slightly different is that I went a little more product oriented, and I had a little more sales and marketing. He was sort of about a little less sort of public and get stuff out there. And so, you know, my story is more like I, as an entrepreneur, I think, and I find it almost embarrassing to say it, but I think I've become more and more comfortable with the fact that I'm actually a marketer, you know, a packager. Like I can put an idea together and tell a good story about it and make it compelling. And so like my early days were literally, where you sort of saw my skills as an entrepreneur. I can tell you a couple of different stories, but one was just Boy Scouts selling calendars and, I remember I was at the fair and I sold like, I don't know, five times as many as the second guy in terms of sales. I just had this ability, and you know, I guess I was this cute little kid, and I was pretty fearless, and so so that was one. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Sound yeah, good? Totally. Yeah, we're good.
Good. I'm sure. The other one I can think of was being on vacation with in Barbados. We went there a few times with the family, and there are these sand dollars that you can find in the ocean, and then you can sadly take them and then bleach them, and they make these like really beautiful little sand dollars. And so I did that, and then I recruited my twin sisters, who are a couple years younger than me, as salespeople, and we basically would go and sell them to tourists. You know, so there's just like there's something inside me that just wanted to, you know, make and sell things. I did, you know, I made towel racks, and like I always had some sort of scheme to make and sell things. My mom was a real estate agent, and then acted as a therapist for a little while, and then was a teacher for a long time in women's studies. And so I think her impact on me was more, she's bookish and really lovely and very, very smart. But she has very strong morals, like a real sense of fairness and just doing the right thing. She's that annoying person that, you know, the big company, charges you less than they should, and she'd be the one that would tell them, you know, she will do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And she also, and this is wrapping into the next question a little bit, but her and my stepdad were like the first people to get a Prius, you know, from very, very early. And they've done amazingly nerdy things, like a few years ago now, they did the 100-mile diet, where they basically, and this is in Quebec, they lived for a month trying to only use eat and only use like energy from the sun, and they were biking everywhere, and then they were, all the stuff they were eating needed to come from less than 100 miles away. So mom's big gardener, and so yeah, I mean, you know, what sort of set of parents in their, you know, 50s does weird stuff like that. So they also help, they helped out, worked with disabled skiers, doing that for a while, and so they're just sort of lovely. So I come from, you know, these, my parents like do things a little differently, and really a lot of it is just based on sort of their strong views of the world and wanting to do things right.
It seems to me like you've had this ongoing theme of curiosity and inquisitiveness throughout your life. And as somebody who's maintained it throughout your life, I'm curious how people bring it back in their adult lives, especially if they've lost it. Because it seems to me that it's something that we lose. You know, I mean, this is something that always struck me. I remember walking through a Barnes & Noble, and you know how they have those sections for education where they'll list, you know, this is for first graders, this is for second graders, this is for third graders, and so on. And as you progress, the thing that really struck me is that the opportunity for self-expression diminishes with each level of school that you go through.
Mm. So there's what you mean. So you're looking at the books and
I'm looking at the books in general, but I mean, I see this as a pattern, you know, at least from what I've seen in my life is that, you know, your creativity, your curiosity, all these things need to be woken up again in some way. And you seem to have maintained this sense throughout your entire life. And I'm wondering, you know, how people do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like our society, there's a lot of settling, you know, there's a lot of like, time to get serious, like, you know, you can't like just going, okay, well, I can't really do that. I have to do, you know, I have to be responsible, and I have to do this thing. And listen, I mean, I think the reality is that, well, certainly in for me, I'm you know, I've made some money, so I'm very, very fortunate. That I have more latitude to, you know, I don't have to be responsible. So, so that's, you know, I mean, you know, if you live in the U.S. and like we're so incredibly fortunate. So, you know, some people just really in a way don't have that opportunity. Mm. And so, but yeah, our society definitely drives towards, okay, it's time to settle. I got to settle with this woman, I got to settle with this job, I got to settle with, I can't move again, and it drives us towards that. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's hard. It's a bit of a hard question. I mean, I guess I could do the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I've even done it differently in terms of making money. Like often there's, you know, you make money and there's a certain path you're meant to follow, and I haven't particularly followed that. I don't know. I mean, curiosity is like, I'm definitely, like, I literally, my parents would say no more questions. And yeah, I mean, I'm a little bummed that they said that, but I probably was really, really annoying. And it's, I'm very lucky that I do really have the curiosity, and it extends to so many different areas that, I mean, it's a bummer sometimes. Like, you want to, like, I'm 46 now. Like, I'm bummed that I probably have 40 years left. You know, like, it's, there's so many things that I would like to do and to explore. And it's tough. So I guess I'm lucky. I often, like, when people are, like, trying to figure out what they want to do, my suggestion is hit a magazine or, like, a news agency, a magazine store kind of thing. And, you know, don't get too fussy about it. Just like, go. What are you drawn to? If there are like 500 magazines there. Like, if you're buying 10 of them, what are they, and what parts of them are really attractive to you? Where do you end up going? Because I think that's, you know, that's where you want to go, and that's your curiosity, right? What am I interested in?
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Design Crowd. Unmistakable Creative listeners have used Design Crowd for logo, web, and graphic design. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you set up your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like the designs you get, you can then approve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. To see what other Unmistakable Creative listeners have designed and save $100 on your first project, visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. They host your website and they have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. An easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, one-click WordPress installs, and if you want to switch from an existing host to HostGator, it's free and it's simple. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. So walk me through sort of the trajectory of your career and like how, you know, you've ended up, like what's been the significant inflection points and how you ended up to the point where you've built Life Edited?
Significant inflection points. Probably, I mean, I was, I was an older child, and my childhood was a little difficult, as, you know, many people's are. And I think my reaction to it was, you know, going to the world of ideas and like really focusing on schoolwork and that sort of stuff instead of like rebelling as some do. So I did fairly well in school, and then I was very fortunate in that I got to try all sorts of different things. So I was at a tiny school called the Country School, run by parents. And then I was in French school, and I was in English school, and I was in like mostly in public school. And then I would say a big inflection point, or two inflection points sort of in my schooling, was I got to go to a private school called Bishop's College School in Quebec. And I'm very fortunate and happy that I was able to see both, you know, mostly public, but also have private school. And when I got there, it just like it's what all the brochures say, you know, open your horizons and all that bullshit. Like, it's totally true. Like, I went there and all of a sudden I was around people that were really pushing. And so they pushed me in my schooling, and they pushed me in sports, and it was just so great. And all these different people from, you know, often from successful families, which, you know, is a money thing, but it often comes from people who are smart and dedicated and driven and creative. And so really interesting people and of all nationalities from everywhere. And so I think that really changed the direction of my life and really opened stuff up. And I'm really thankful for my parents for spending the money for me to go to that year, because it was a new thing and it was sort of a big deal for them. And that led to me getting a scholarship to a school in Germany. And so I ended up going to this for free, for a year, to this school in Germany. And actually, I should back up one second. So I'm at this private school, and I apply to university. I'm applying to engineering, and I'm still want to be an engineer to this day. But I get the coursework. I open it up. I think I was accepted into like Western or something in Ontario. I open it up, and it's basically math. And I quite like math. Like, I'm one of those weirdos that enjoyed calculus. But I just was like, no, this is not, I pretty much slammed it shut. I was like, I'm not doing this. It's just like, that does not feel right. And so I was young, because I had skipped a grade, and my birthday's in September. And so that's when I decided to take a year off and sort of figure out what I wanted to do. And so I ended up going to this round square school in Germany called Zollum for free, which was in this castle. And it was like, I don't know, $36,000 or something crazy. And it was all like the you know, upper crust, largely, you know, definitely some scholarship stuff as well, but of, you know, Germans and princes and princesses and captains of industry and all this in southern Germany. And so it was fascinating, and I got to really see Europe and understand, you know, a whole different way. And, you know, Germany is just an incredible place with a real focus on sustainability and quality, and I learned a new language, and I studied architecture there. Basically, I got into photography, and that's sort of what led me to go towards architecture. So I ended up right after that, I got another scholarship, luckily, to do Outward Bound in Australia, which was an unbelievable experience. And then I ended up, I applied into architecture at Carleton University in Ottawa, which is one of the better schools in Canada, if not maybe the best, I guess, depending on how you look at it, for architecture. And I didn't even apply anywhere else. So I was so cocky / stupid because I scraped in. Like, I was on the waiting list. Like, I barely made it. So I ended up there, and architecture is a fantastic education, and it really taught me how to work and get organized. And it's like, it's art, but it's engineering. So there's a lot to it. And it's a beautiful education. I'm really glad I did it. And I literally worked my ass off as everyone does for like 5 years straight. Sure, I threatened to quit every single year, just because it was a lot. One of the sort of inflection points, I guess, although now I'm circling back to real estate, is that I found out about industrial design. I dated this woman named Allison Phillips, who was in the industrial design program, and back then the sort of before Eve Bahar and there weren't these industrial design superstars out there, just wasn't known. So I, like, despite wanting to be an inventor, I ended up in architecture because I didn't sort of realize that there was a school for invention, which is really product design, industrial design. And so dating this woman, Allison, led me to sort of understand that. And so that was an inflection point in that after architecture, in the last year, we somehow got bored, which makes no sense because we had so much work, but we started a clothing company and a band. We made these like sort of, snowboard hats and stuff. We were early into snowboarding and living in Whistler and stuff in the summer. And so we just got Grant Vanderslat and Don Collins and I started this thing called Three Brothers. God, it's so weird being able to talk at length in an interview. so a slight sidebar on that. So we did, for whatever reason, doesn't make any sense. We were like, school politics. I wonder if we should get involved in that. And so we were so busy with architecture that we basically got one seat, and then we called it the Three Brothers because that's what Grant and Don and I were called. And so we could sort of sit on student council, but not one of us could be there each time instead of all three of us. And so it sort of made it manageable. Anyway, so Three Brothers ended up being the name of the company, the clothing company. And that it went well. We made a whole bunch of skater kind of clothing. We're very big into sort of skateboarding, snowboarding at that point. And we got in like 25 stores across Canada. And we had this, we found this like old vintage suitcase and we rigged it with like three styrofoam heads inside on a shelf, sort of set into the back panel. And so we'd open it up and then you'd see these three styrofoam heads with different our hats, and then in the base of it would be all the hats we were selling. And so when we drove out to Whistler, we would just stop by all these stores and go in with our traveling suitcase and sell hats. and then we did belt buckles and jackets and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, that was a lot of fun and really ended up a hobby. It's hard to, the learning there was that in fashion, you got to sort of either be, low volume and high price or high volume and low price. And we were sort of neither. And so we learned a lot and that got me a job later on working for Board of Authority as like a production and designer in production. But but yeah, what we had to abandon that. But so one of the inflection points was really out in, it was spending some time out in Whistler. I was working construction because it was fabulous money, and we just had so much fun up in Whistler, mountain biking and rock climbing and snowboarding and et cetera, et cetera. I just really fell in love with the West Coast and Vancouver area, and that, and so there's a great school called Emily Carr, which is on, I think they're moving actually, but they're on Granville Island, which is this lovely little island right in the middle of Vancouver in the city. And so I applied for product design. You know, I always wanted to be an inventor, and I didn't realize that that schooling existed. And I'd done this 5 years of architecture, and I guess I just wasn't quite ready. And so that's, so that was a big one. So I went there, and it was nice in that it was different, because I really was there not necessarily to get a degree, but more just to learn about how to do product design. And it, architecture had been so non-computer oriented. Our school was like so behind. Like, we literally had like Fortran 77, like the war games green terminal thing where you, anyway, so it would take you a bunch of lines of code just to draw a line. Like, it was just really, really, really behind. And so computers were this is sort of Apple II era, maybe even before, were big at Emily Carr. And so the big inflection point there is that just finally I got into computers, and I did 3D Max and AutoCAD, and I just learned how to do 3D modeling. And so that was really inspiring, because so this is like CD-ROM time. That just for me, it was like a small team could do something that could be seen the world over. And I really appreciated that. And that you could really control the entire environment and really create something amazing that way. But probably the biggest thing and what really led to my sort of career moves from there was that Emily Carr had a fast connection to the internet. And we had Pine email. And so this is, you know, 93, 94 kind of thing, so quite early. And we also had a – how's that sound?
That's fine. We're good. Keep going.
Doing it right outside the window. So we had a graphical web terminal is what they were called then, which was basically a computer in the library, one of them, that had the graphical web, so the web with pictures. And so when I saw that, I was doing all the CD-ROM stuff. I was like, wow, that's it. And I just, for whatever reason, I just was like, the internet, just like, it's so obvious. And so I want to do work in that area. And so that was a very big point. And so I think I was sort of trying to figure out how I could do some work up in Vancouver. And then my lovely cousin, Tish Hill, I was down in Seattle, and she was she had been doing sort of CD-ROM stuff in the dental world, in fact, and we'd kept in touch and were always close, and so I basically rode my illegal motorcycle down the day after school ended, and from Emily Carr Product Design down to Seattle, bunked in with her and her husband Brian, and we set about trying to start a web company, building websites. We just thought that was it. And we there were about four of us at the time, Jeff Hughes and Ophir Ronan, Dish and myself. And we would sort of have breakfast meetings, and we'd be pitching people. And in this time, it was a time where people would confuse their email addresses with their website addresses. Like, that's how early it was. and so it was like pre-Netscape, you know, it was like Mosaic browser kind of thing, like. Microsoft wasn't in on anything. Like, it was really early. And so I had like a $200 a room tiny room in this big loft in downtown Seattle, which is really fun, and this motorcycle, and we just kept on pushing, and effectively what happened is Tish ended up getting a job out at Microsoft, just helping do project management for stuff, and we were able to pitch her, the person that she worked for there, on doing some web stuff. And so I wrote up this $11,000 proposal, which was more money than I could possibly believe at that point, to do some web work for them, this woman, Mary Mucci. And we got it. And then we, you know, pulled in contractors that really knew their stuff, because we didn't know that much. did good work, and sort of went from there. And so that was definitely an inflection point. So we grew this company largely on Microsoft from the two of us. It was four of us, I guess. The two other guys left pretty quickly. And so it was really Tish and I, and we built the company to 60 people over 3 years, doing millions and millions of dollars of web development. And we sold it to a New York firm called Bowne, B-O-W-N-E, who's a big financial printer. And so that was definitely a big moment. And so I'm like, it was an interesting period. So, you know, I'm at 28 years old. All of a sudden, I made a bunch of money, and it was quite heady. I had all these people working for me, or for us, I should say, for Tish and myself. And you know, all of a sudden, I didn't have to worry about money so much. And so, I ended up running they asked me to run an office and bought one of the companies. They bought their office in Boston, so I was up there for a few months, but only under the promise that I would get to New York. I've always loved New York, and I just felt like people walk my speed here. I just felt right, and I wanted to get there. And so that's how I sort of finagled my way there. And then I ended up I was like New York City. It's in more than any place in the world, probably, or one of them anyway. Like, what you do is who you are, period. Like, people ask you, it's like almost before, how are you? It's like, what do? It's just so critical. And so the irony was, I was being a man of leisure for a bit, trying to figure out what's next. And so I was doing nothing. You know, I had nothing going on. I finally left the company. And so I had this sort of interesting period of identity crisis in a way, my early, you know, late 20s, early 30s, where I had this very heady experience, and now I had some money and some real, you know, flexibility to pick whatever I wanted. So I had like an early midlife crisis. It was a tough period. I had some depression, and it was challenging. And where I effectively sort of ended up was I ended up being part of this small environmental group. I somehow ended up at some meeting for this group called the Natural Step, and liked it. And I'd always had this leaning towards that stuff. And so we had this little group, and it just got me really into green. And we used to have people over to my loft and have these meetings, and we put together the Interdependent Film Festival, and all on sort of green topics. And so it just got me really interested. And so I read Ecology of Commerce and Natural Capitalism, a couple of Paul Hawken books that were really formative. And I ended up, my first sort of next business really was, I got really excited about how plants clean the air. And so I set about, for about a year and a half, I worked on trying to create a plant-based air filter that would run air through the soil of a plant. And so I made a specific planter with a special soil and a fan, et cetera. And it would basically run the air through, and the microbes in the soil would break down the pollutants. And so you could have this beautiful air filter. I wanted something that was small and inexpensive, and effectively it ended up being sort of big and expensive, and I got some sort of bad advice along the way, and people ended up doing it, but I know how to do it. It's just the problem is it really has to be sort of big. It's more like trunk size to do anything meaningful. But the couple of things came out of that. One, I ended up down in Peru and I wanted to make them out of the vessels out of ceramics, and so I found, with this group called Aid to Artisans, I found this group down there, and I basically bunked in with some family, and then I would go into the factory and work with this guy Chino on the wheel, and basically I would, you know, draw stuff up, and my Spanish was pretty crap, but we would figure it out, and he would make stuff, and so we did all these prototypes, and as a designer with a factory guy that would make anything for me, I just really took advantage of it. And so I made a ton of different designs. And one of the things I came up with at that time was we have a site called wearehappytoserveyou.com. So there's a cup that you may be familiar with. It's an iconic New York paper coffee cup. It's like, I don't know, 12 ounces, 10 ounces or something. And it's blue and it has a sort of Greek design. And it's, it has some like steaming coffees and it says, "We are happy to serve you" on the side. And this was back in like the 60s, I guess. Most of the delis were Greek owned in New York. And so they made this cup to appeal to that, to those owners. And Solo Cup Company ended up owning it. And so I always loved the cup. It's a beautiful cup and it's just this iconic thing, but it's, you know, it's ephemeral. You throw it out. And so I thought it would be really cool to have sort of make an environmental comment about the disposable coffee cup culture, but also just create a useful souvenir. And so people could bring it home. And so I somehow worked the phone all the way around the Solo Cup Company and was able to negotiate a license and made this prototype. And we got it with my lovely ex-girlfriend, Olga Susplugas. We set about trying to sell them into stores. And like Pearl River might have been our first. But we ended up eventually getting it into MoMA. And it's been a bestseller there for like 10 years. So we, this little cup, basically have a, we ended up, we have a handful of products. We have a smaller version and we have an I Love New York cup, but you know, mostly just this one product company. And I think we've probably sold 350,000-400,000 of them over the years. And Olga still runs it virtually from Spain. And so that was a, you know, silver lining out of trying to do the air filter was I ended up finding this other business. And so back to sort of the pathway. So at this, about the same time I was doing the cup, I was part of this, the organization I was telling you, this Natural Step, our own little sort of offshoot that we'd meet. And I think I got frustrated. I just wanted to do things, and it seemed like there were a lot of answers, but I wanted to do things. And I got really frustrated with environmental media in general, in that at that time, this is like 2004, it seemed like it was either sort of nonprofits that didn't have a lot of resources and were really sort of careful and, you know, non-design forward and sort of, you know, boring, and or it was like little labors of love by people out there and they just didn't, you know, just didn't have the time to or the funds to really dedicate to it. And most of the environmental movement at that point was about no, it was about stop this and stop that and inspire by fear. And while that is a really important, I think it takes a number of different approaches and inspire by fear is one of them. And Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth is definitely largely that, and it really, really made a difference. I just felt like there's a real opening in the environmental media space, and what we needed was something that was inspired by hope and that was really design forward and exciting and about yes. And so I set out about doing that. It just was like the hippies were the ones who sort of owned the environmental movement. And I love the hippies. And, you know, I definitely have a big part of me is a hippie. But we are shallow, shallow beings. And aesthetics really matter. And, you know, hippies is a very small part of our society and was really already sold to. They were already, you know, being delivered to. And so, you know, my basic concept was like, what about if we could put together something, an environmental site that was really designed forward, was really positive and would allow you to live in a city and wear a collared shirt and call yourself an environmentalist that would add to, would appeal to a different, much, much larger market than the hippies were. And so that's where Tree Hugger was born. And Tree Hugger was and remains to be a you know, tongue-in-cheek name. And so it's, you know, Tree Hugger is actually very non-Tree Hugger, but it just was a very memorable, fun name. And so we ran with it. And so it was and is this blog that was, you know, focused on design forward product design and furniture and architecture and fashion and some environmental news and more of that later. But just trying to get people really psyched about the environment and that we could live in a way that, you know, felt better morally but also was really exciting and just made sense and was about efficiency and design. And so that was a big turning point. And I had become friends with this guy named Nick Denton, who you are probably familiar with. And,
yes.
When I was the founder of Gawker. And so he had basically Gawker and Gizmodo and maybe one other at that point. And I'd been thinking about this environmental media idea for quite a while already. And basically Nick was like, hey, you know, here's your platform. Like, you should do it. And he was doing it. And so I did. And so he was, you know, very helpful. And so all of a sudden we had this blogging platform that was just inexpensive. And so we were very lucky. Like, you know, Nick was able to say, I didn't waste too much time. You know, what blogging platform? This one. Okay, I'll do it. Wait, no, what should I do here? Okay. So I got a bunch of early advice from him and just went for it. And at those days in New York, largely, I guess, it was very incestuous. So all the blogs were linking back and forth to each other. And so we had this really cool new thing that really appealed to people. And we were, you know, very much in Malcolm Gladwell, you know, speaks of this outlier sort of right place, right time, you know. Mm-hmm. We're just very fortunate. It was very incestuous, and that really helped us build our traffic because everyone was sort of working together. And so Triggr went very well, and we were, you know, very quickly the biggest green site out there, and you know, maintained that for a number of years until the big boys really started using their power to send traffic to their sites. But we created this amazing thing, and I was just very lucky and had a fantastic team, and we just did some really great work. And I'm like, 3 years later, I sold to Discovery, and they were really, really great. And have continued to support. And then they did a joint venture with Mother Nature News, MNN, and they've just continued. And it's still going. So I'm very proud of, you know, having been the catalyst for that, and very proud of the amazing team that have done that. And I think, you know, what bigger than that, though, is really for me, is the ripple effect. And I'm friends with this guy, Blake Mycoskie, who's the founder of Tom's, and we were talking about this recently. You know, your main project's great, you know, really important, but if you can have a ripple effect, that is just so much larger. So, you know, do something that really gets people to copy or influences people. And so Treehugger, what I'm really proud of is that we showed that there was a business in green. And that you could do it in a different way. It could be, you know, design forward and positive, et cetera. And so we are I know for a fact we're part of, you know, hundreds of business plans. And so we really helped sort of pave the way for as a reference point for people. And so while I'm very proud of Treehugger, what I'm more proud of is, I think, the ripple effect we've had. And, you know, for Blake, it would be really, you know, popularizing the one for one. You know, he, like, Tom's has done amazing stuff over the years, and it's, you know, a very big company. But way bigger is just the ripple effect that, you know, he really got people thinking about one for one and got people thinking about doing businesses that made a difference, but yet still were for profit.
This episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by 2020, where creatives go to get inspiring, authentic stock photos. If you're tired of scrolling through uninspiring staged images, check out 2020. Their images are crowdsourced from real-world photographers, and you can choose from millions of high-quality photos available under a simple royalty-free license. And today, 2020 is offering Unmistakable Creative listeners a free trial of 5 photos so you can see for yourself. To start your trial, go to 2020.com/unmistakable. That's the word 20, then 20.com/unmistakable. To get your first 5 photos for free.
So those were the big ones. And then I guess the final inflection point was more, was really what I'm up to now, which is Life Edited. And that's, that came about, as is often the case, I think, with entrepreneurs, just you have a personal project that you can't help but turn into a business. And so it really started with, you know, I sold 2 companies and I had 7 years of design school. So I had some money and some design skills, and I still, you know, I was in my mid to late 30s, and I'm still living like a student. I'm just so focused on other stuff, and just envious of designer friends who had like cool apartments, and also just wanting to live in a green manner. mm-hmm. and be able to really show people and invite, have interviews at my apartment and just sort of show people how to live. And we've done a lot of, in a way, life edited. Treehugger was really like helping point the way to people, like sharing and inspiring. And life edited is more about, you know, doing it. Yeah. And so that it's like, it's really clear, you know, this is exactly how you do it. Do this and really living it. And so I set out to buy an apartment in New York City. Unfortunately, not in 99, but in like 2010. So never bought. I just stupidly rented the whole time. In looking at it, I realized we had been talking a lot on Treehugger about the size of apartments and how that basically every cubic foot that you add to a home is a cubic foot that you have to build out of stuff, you know, the walls and the ceilings and all that. You have to fill full of stuff, all your possessions and furniture and everything. And then you have to light it, and you have to heat it, and you have to cool it, and you have to clean it, and you have to insure it and repair it. At some point, perhaps move it. Think about it. Like there's a lot that comes with it, with every cubic foot. And so if you could design a place with less cubic feet, you just had less of all those things. And so the easiest way to go green is to start by just going smaller. And just realize that particularly in the US, there's this real phenomenon. We've over the last 60 odd years supersized ourselves in this crazy way. So we have, it used to be 1,000 square feet per person, 1,000 square feet was sort of the average housing size back in like the 50s, and now it's like 2,700 with smaller families. So, you know, the big numbers are we have 3 times the space per person that we used to. I mean, it's crazy. And while at the same time that over in Europe, those poor Europeans with their terrible lifestyles are living with 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it just didn't make sense to me. And our happiness levels have flatlined since the 50s. So we have all this space and a $22 billion personal storage industry to store more stuff. But we're not any happier. We're burning. Our footprints are like 4 times as large as they were back there. And we have more debt. And so it just was like clear, hey, something's not working here. And so what I set out to do with Life Edited and really my first apartment was to create something that had the functionality of a space much larger. So it would do everything that I needed to do, but in less space, and therefore, you know, add green materials and, you know, buy green electricity, you know, heat recovery ventilator, and had like a little composter, a nature mill composter, et cetera, et cetera. You could really create something environmental. And so I did this neat thing at the time. There had been very little crowdsourcing in architecture. And so I sort of ran this with Jovoto, this company out of Berlin. Put together a really aggressive brief, and I bought this 420 square foot apartment, and then we raised like $80,000 from like Cisco and Resource Furniture and a whole bunch of other sponsors, and ran this contest and got 300 entries from around the world, all like really focusing on, you know, on the space and how to make the most efficient use of it. We picked this these guys from Romania, and ended up hiring one of them, Catalin, and we basically built out their scheme with very little changes, and it was great. And I lived in it for a while, like a couple of years, and ended up doing a TED talk about it, and which has gotten like 3 million views. And I wrote a New York Times op-ed, which was very popular, most read thing on the New York Times for a week straight, and I think fourth most popular op-ed. And so what was just interesting is like this personal project that I took on appeals to our society. It's like intuitively we are really attracted to this idea. We understand, most of us, that something's not working here. Things are overwhelming. Things are too much. We're desiring this a simpler life, and that's why, you know, a silly
op-ed or a TED talk about, you know, living small could actually be really popular. Like, if you think of it, it doesn't make much sense. Not that I'm like some amazing public speaker or writer or something. It's like, it's just that our society knows something's off here and people are desiring it. And I think the way that you found me was in the Minimalists documentary thing on Netflix. I think it also illustrates it. Like, the something called The Minimalist could get that much traction. I mean, I think every friend that I have has seen it and texted me a screen grab of it. Like, yeah, that thing went huge. And so I think intuitively we just all know this is not working, and we want something smaller. The world's sort of overwhelming. So yeah, so Life Edited, I give a bunch of talks and we have a newsletter on lifeedited.com, and we haven't been doing much posting for a bit, but basically what we're trying to do is we realize that if we're smart about how we apply design, mm-hmm, technology, and perhaps a little behavior change, that we can create really compelling ways of living that save us some money, that reduce our footprints drastically, and that a simpler life is a happier life. And so we're sort of setting about to do that. And so we do various sort of runway projects. We're working with sponsors where we build up these rad apartments or this 1,000-square-foot off-grid place I'm working on in Maui. And then we're also doing some development with partners, Jason Holiday and Leah Solomon out in Brooklyn, where we'll buy and renovate and sell housing, and we're sort of building up from there. So those are probably the
what you asked and answered a lot of my questions. I have two final questions because we've got about 7 more minutes here. One of the things that I was very curious about, having seen that, was what do you guys think the impact on poverty is going to be as a result of this? Like, do you think it will lead to a reduction in poverty?
I mean, I think at the highest level, our challenge is that our society is built on infinite growth. You know, companies have to grow, stock has to grow, populations have to grow on a finite sphere. And so I think if those just collide at some point.
Yeah.
And I think we're just seeing them collide. This is finite stuff. We only have so much oil, so much lithium, so much whatever. Like, so we have to start being smart about it. And you know, it's a negative sort of look, but you know, you could certainly look at humans as like a cancer on the earth. Like, we have really, I mean, I think we can be smarter than that, and we can be better than that. We just have to acknowledge we can't grow infinitely. We have to be sustainable. Sustainable just means something that like lasts, that is done in a way that makes sense and has a lifetime instead of just burns out. And so I think that smart, efficient, smaller living could have a big effect. Like, I think we need to swing the pendulum back from cribs, you know, and send a new message. And just, I think more and more people and celebrities also are realizing, you know, your happiness level after like 75, 100,000 a year, like studies show it just doesn't go up. Like, once you can live in a decent place and go for dinner and take some vacations, like, you know, there's not much after that. It doesn't get that much better. And so, you know, what's important are experiences and connection and relationships and that ginormous house with that, you know, second media room or the formal dining room that you forget that you have and never use. Like, they're not working for us, and they cost us a huge amount in terms of our footprint. They cost us financially, and they're just a pain in the ass because you got to think about them and deal with them and manage them. And so as someone who's, you know, made some money over the years, I'm like, you know, my last apartment, the one I have now in New York, is 350 square feet, and it's awesome. And you know, so do you have to live in 350? No. And if you're a big family, you know, have more. But I think we just want to head the other way, and I think that'll help poverty overall. I mean, I think it's just, it's already happening. Small living's already happening. Unfortunately, it's just not happening in a very sanitary or healthy, or sorry, safe manner. And so I think my hope is that we can just live smarter. We don't need these McMansions, and we can understand that the gravy above 100,000, you can put it to work for other people, and we can get the whole world in a happier, better place.
Well, I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Creativity for me is just looking at things in new ways, right? It's basically not accepting the status quo. And it's always, there's always like when you see something really creative, there's like an aha, like, oh, it's almost obvious. Mm-hmm. And so there's this just doing something different. And so, someone who's unmistakably creative, it's like, it's just sort of just hits you. It's sort of like obvious. And I guess maybe like if it's a person that you're looking at, I think you can really see if they're coming from the right place. And like a real artist, like you can tell the difference when someone is doing it because they have to do it. In a good way. I mean, they're driven to do it. It's not like they would be doing this whether people were watching or not. I think that's the really big one. They are flowing. They're in the flow, doing their thing, and they have to do it, and they're in a great way. They're excited to do it, but it's not calculated. They're not sort of calculating, okay, well, if I do this, then I'm going to make a bunch of money. Got to do it. Like the real entrepreneurs, and there are some that aren't like this, but I think in general, it's the people that aren't that calculated. They're just doing it because they can't help themselves from doing it. And I think that those are the people that sort of unmistakably creative, and you can just tell. They have a certain passion and joy, and they're doing it for the right reasons because they can't help themselves. In the entrepreneurial space, I think it's often that they're solving some problem. Tree Hugger happened because it was from frustration, right? Like I had I think all entrepreneurs have a certain amount of arrogance. You need it because you're basically saying, that's not working, and I know there's a better way of doing it, and I'm going to do it. And so, I think for me, Tree Hugger was like, this is silly. Like, there's a better way to do this, and I'm going to try to do it.
Awesome. Well, I think that makes a very fitting end to our conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story with our listeners, because something like you said, something about just seeing, what you were talking about, the minimalism documentary really struck me. And I felt that was an important conversation to put another light on. So
thank you. I think next time, it's very odd just being able to go on and on. And as you just witnessed, I can talk. But it's very, it's like there's some place in between. I guess I had to remember that it was an hour long.
No worries.
So anyway, it was really fun. Awesome. It was really fun to chat to you. Awesome. And congrats. I really like what you guys are doing. And I'm a listener.
Awesome.
So keep at it.
And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.